Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. We are conducting an exclusive interview with Robert Beggs, International Security Authority, Board Member, Sector Advisory Council, President, Digital Defense. Robert, thank you for coming in today to share your deep insights with the audience.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Robert, can you provide a profile of your roles and challenges?
I'm involved with a firm called Digital Defense, and we specialize in penetration testing, incident response, data forensics. And these reflect the challenges that we're facing in the entire security environment right now. To start off with, probably our first challenge is how do you most effectively test a network in order to prevent an attacker from getting in? And we're finding it's just becoming very complex, particularly as networks extend geographically, as well as the means of connecting into them and how they're sharing information. In fact, sometimes even identifying what information a network has on it can be quite challenging. We're also seeing right now that the nature of attacks that we have to deal with is changing. Attacks are coming faster. Probably about 50 to 70% of all attacks now are automated. The attacks that come in are complex, particularly the insider attacks now, because insiders are motivated not just by maliciousness, as was in the past, but they're actually finding ways to profit from their internal attacks. So the amount of fraud and internal theft is increasing, and it's getting harder both to recognize and to fix. And so among all this, we're trying to work with identifying the best ways that we can respond and help our clients respond to a very challenging environment.
What are your recommendations for security governance and defense in depth?
Stephen, that's an excellent question, because frequently when people speak about security governance, they're talking about following some set of regulations or protocols. For example, they seem to tie security governance to being ISO certified or complying with PCI standards. And they say that our executive, you know, is committed to security governance because they have made us follow this set of standards. So the biggest recommendation we have is, before you adopt a set of standards, governance will only come from having a committed executive. The next recommendation is you've got to build on that committed executive, and you've got to translate their will to be secure into some sort of means of providing the security. And I think everyone's very familiar with putting in a defense-in-depth type strategy to achieving this. Firewalls on the outside, some intrusion detection systems, some antivirus, and some policies and practices around this. And that is the accepted defense in depth. But the greatest recommendation I can make is to carry that defense in depth strategy one step further in from the edge, and that is to involve end users as being a part of your defense in depth strategy. And Stephen, what I mean by this is typically IT staff who are responsible for taking security governance and making it real focus on technology, because that's what they know best. What they have to do is focus on bringing that technology to the end user, because it's your end user who's going to be the person that sits back and says, my computer is acting strangely, maybe there's a virus, maybe I picked up malware. The end user, your people that are using computers in general workaday, are actually your best person to employ as a first responder. So the recommendation that I have is, don't look at defense in depth as technology. Look at the defense in depth for people. Take it from the executive all the way through to the average employee, and make sure that they have a part in bringing security to the network, and they understand their part, and that there's overlap between what the different functions are, so that you're going to get exactly the same view of security from people as you would from technology.
Well, that's some pretty good advice there, where you're providing quite a holistic kind of approach to all of this.
And I think holistic is a really important word, because it brings to mind to people, move away from the technology focus we've had and integrate it with the people and the processes, and apply the same principles to those people and processes. And we found that that's probably the most cost-effective way of improving security in a network.
So now, when we get to virus protection and so forth, what are your recommendations in terms of, let's say, best practices?
One of the things that we found from virus protection is people put on an antivirus package, and there are probably 20 to 30 products commonly in use, and these packages are all recognizing a virus or a piece of malware by looking for a very specific signature. And that is the accepted best practice of finding a virus. We know, however, from retrospective studies, that right at this point, your antivirus is only picking up 60 to 70%, sometimes less, of the viruses that are out there. Because the attackers write their viruses to bypass the detection of this one signature. So the very first thing, the best practice you can do, is an implicit recognition that all signature-based antivirus products are going to fail. Once you recognize that, then you can start employing best practices to minimize the impact of this failure. The first one is very obvious, and that is don't rely on one single antivirus product. All right? Again, defense-in-depth strategy, you're minimizing the opportunity for a piece of malware to bypass both at the same time. The other thing that you've got to do, and this is where it starts becoming complex, is you have to manage that antivirus product. And when I say that antivirus product, I mean everything, the totality of antivirus that you've got on your network. And you could have one vendor's product, you could have five. You need to centrally manage it and enforce the policies. You cannot afford to let one single user disable antivirus because they want to run a particular program. You've got to be able to, in a very auditable way, have a central point that pushes out a policy that says antivirus will be installed on the system, it will be updated with this frequency, and I can look at a chart and see all the machines that are in compliance, and I can get flagged with the ones that aren't, so I can go out and address those as potential issues. So the recommendations for virus protection: acknowledge the potential for failure, minimize the impact by having multiple overlapping products, control the use of those products, and then finally, and this is going to be the big one, and that is be prepared for the eventual failure and that you will have malware resident on your system at some point in time. And then if you recognize that, you're prepared for the next steps, which are how do you deal with malware resident on your system?
So that's a good segue into what are your recommendations for malware removal?
And Stephen, that's one of the most difficult questions. To a large extent, it is dependent on what exactly the malware is, because different types of malware, for example, some spyware, it sticks like a burr to a dog. And the only way to get it out is if you try to delete a piece of malware, you'll see that all of a sudden it pops up on your system again. So there are various tools, and Microsoft and Mark Rusinovich have developed things such as PS Explorer that allow you to put processes to sleep. So you can go in onto a system and look at all instances of a piece of malware, put it into sleep mode, and while it's asleep, then you can remove it from your system without it doing a lookup and adding itself back into the system as you're removing it. Malware is very complex. And generally there are known steps for removing it. You can go online and find these steps. But there's one step that significantly most companies don't pay any attention to. And that is, when you're done, the after-action step of saying, how exactly did this malware get here? For example, Stephen, one of the problems that we've been seeing is answering exactly how malware got onto a system. And we've been doing a lot of research and finding out that one of the primary means is programs that release or share software using a torrent. We have found through research that up to 80% of all the software that comes through these publicly available torrents is infected with malware. So that a person will download it onto their system, they'll open it up to look at a particular application, put that onto their system, and in doing so, they are infecting through a backdoor that's very hard to control their system and the corporate network. So the challenge that comes about in removing the virus is really the challenge of trying to find out how it got there and trying to assess the damage that's been done.
That's some really good advice, Robert. I can see your breadth of experience come into play here. What can you say about corporate espionage?
Corporate espionage has been ongoing for years, and it's corporate espionage in the past tended to be very high level. During the dot-boom era of the 90s, corporate espionage picked up, and it was very prevalent in electronic firms, firms that handled hardware, firms that did, for example, design of advanced chips. What we're seeing now is that what you call corporate espionage has moved down to smaller firms, and there's a couple reasons for that. Number one, large firms, such as, for example, maybe a bank or maybe a Fortune 500 company, are outsourcing to a greater degree certain parts of their business to smaller firms. In order to facilitate that, they give the smaller firms exactly the same data that they have been guarding so carefully themselves. The only problem is that smaller firms don't have the ability sometimes to treat the data in exactly the same manner. So smaller firms are a more obvious target for stealing data than going after the big firm. So the number of cases is increasing, and we're seeing as well, when you're talking about espionage and going after a particular type of data, the intent is changing. Okay, it's not just I'm going to steal data so that I can build a competing product. I'm going to steal data because that data itself has financial value. So it's very much a money-driven exercise. And interestingly, Stephen, one of the things that we have seen in digital defense is we have been approached by companies to conduct unauthorized penetration tests of competitors. And in fact, and this is a true story, we had one company approach us and ask us to do a penetration test of a competitor because they said, oh, they have taken our data, and our data is residing in their database. And what the request was is for us to go into their competitor, take the database back, and then they would look through it and see and make sure their data was there. In essence, legitimate firms are being asked to commit corporate espionage as a means of acquiring competitive data. What we're seeing across the globe right now is a marked increase in cases of corporate espionage. Now, the types of cases, and we might talk about this when we sort of look at different types of threats, but the cases that we're seeing are not just denial of service, where you try to take your competitor out of action and then profit during their inability to market their goods, but we're seeing theft of information for resale. And as well, an interesting type of corporate espionage is disgruntled insiders that steal intellectual property from a company, then leave that company to form their own competing company. So in essence, you could say that this is an insider theft, or you could say it's pre-corporate espionage.
Robert, with your breadth of experience and your long history of successes and so on, do you have some recommendations of some good products?
Well, and that's a question I get asked frequently, Stephen. What you have to look for in defining what makes a good product is it has to integrate with your network, your end-to-end network. It has to be controllable. And when I say controllable, I'm speaking of two things. From a central point, you have to be able to push out a policy or some sort of criteria of security, have it evenly applied by all devices on your network, and then you have to also have it auditable, because it's not enough for someone to say their network is secure or they've got antivirus on every system. More and more, it's not the stuff that's done well, it's the one or two exceptions that allow an attacker in. So we have to be able to audit and identify exceptions and address them quickly. The last thing that I really have to see in order to say that a product is doing well is it's got to be simple. By simple, I mean two things. First of all, it's got to be transparent to the end user. You cannot ask an end user to govern their own security, because the moment that you ask someone to do something like that, it becomes a chore and people don't like chores. But the people who really don't like chores are the people that have to administer it. And the simplicity means that the overall administration has to be easy. One of the things I've been tracking is Microsoft's Forefront product line. And Stephen, from our perspective, dealing with security across organizations, this is probably the best system that you can use when you need to put in an end-to-end from the edge to the client security system. And I've talked about some of the challenges we've seen, and most of these challenges can be addressed when you start having something that gives you that comprehensive end-to-end manageability and simplicity. So right now, I believe the forefront products extend from the edge where you've got their internet security acceleration server all the way to the client security, which is your antivirus, and it sits on your system. For a Microsoft-based network, this is the most effective way of making sure that you have addressed all the components that the malware is going to be coming across, both coming from the outside in and from the inside going out.
Robert, what are your views on incident response and, you know, the need for agility in responding to a security breach?
Now, that's, you know, and that's the bad news. Thus far, we've been talking to a large extent about when security goes well. Unfortunately, and this is something we've got to recognize, I firmly believe that all companies are going to be a victim of an attack, either from an insider or an outsider. At some point, they are going to be the focus of someone that is trying to compromise their systems. The odds are that their systems will get compromised. Then, the only thing that marks your ability to survive from a business perspective and carry on doing what generates money and keeps your business functional is your ability to respond to that incident in the best manner possible. So what we have developed is a methodology we call Agile Incident Management. And Stephen, it works like this. Traditional incident response waits for something to go wrong. Once something goes wrong, you initiate a plan to deal with it. From a military perspective, you have given the enemy the initiative. They've chosen the ground in the battle. What we want to do is take that type of a thing and turn it into a more manageable experience where it is the business that will be responding to the attacker and making the attacker do what falls into their pre-made plans. So Agile Incident Management is the totality of proactive and the reactive measures to help prevent and manage data security incidents. And we look at it from two perspectives. The first one is what we call a proactive measure. Before a security incident occurs, you have to develop an incident management strategic plan. How are you going to handle an incident? You have to take this plan and integrate it into corporate business strategy. You conduct a risk assessment to make sure that you are addressing the right things. And one of the most important steps is you pre-develop your policy and standard operating procedures. One of the things that we've noticed from security incidents is they tend to happen at 4 in the morning on a Sunday or Christmas Eve or something like this. They happen at times when people aren't prepared to deal with them. So what you want is a pre-made, pre-approved plan where at 4 in the morning you can pick up a piece of paper and do two things. Number one, you can say, I am going to call this person, and you call, and then you take a look at the checklist-type plan, and you write your name and the time you did it, meaning you now have a documented response to a pre-approved incident. And this is probably one of the best ways of keeping track of what you've done and making sure that you comply with regulations and making sure that you're responding effectively. Some of the other proactive measures that we focus on is supporting your technical staff or other responders and by making sure that they've got the training and the tools to respond properly. Now, those are proactive measures that most companies right now are not doing. There's also reactive measures that companies do, and those have to be integrated into that entire process. As well, the nature of reacting to an incident has completely changed. If you have followed typical methodologies, normally when you react to an attack, you pull the plug, and if legal action is going to be involved, you pull out the hard drive, and you take a look at the hard drive forensically and collect evidence. What we're moving towards now, and in fact most companies are starting to recognize the value of, is there's a significant amount of information you should gather before the plug is pulled.
Can you share your expertise on live system forensics, what you should do before you pull the plug?
Well, live, and this is probably one of the most interesting movements and changes in the information security field that's occurring right now, and that is the acknowledgement that a system that is live probably contains about 80 to 90% of the information that you need in order to respond to an incident or even to pursue an attacker who's broken into your network. And it's being driven by a couple different functions. First of all, live system forensics is something that you got to do because there is an increased need to keep a production system alive. You just can't go into a business anymore and say, oh, there may have been a hacker. Let's turn off the Exchange server for the next 5 days while we investigate. You will sometimes have as little as 10 minutes before a system has to be rebooted, put back into production. So the window of opportunity for an investigator has dramatically decreased. At the same time, investigators are faced with terabytes worth of data that they have to go through. If I ask someone to go through my hard drives looking for evidence of a malware attack, my desktop system right now has 6 terabytes of data, and this is just a working workstation on my desk. If you start looking at SANs and some of the mass storage devices, it requires a very focused way of grabbing hold of information before you continue. And the information that you're going to get is what we call the volatile information. And we will collect some non-volatile, like file information and that. But what we're looking at is, here's a system. There may have been a security breach. What can we grab? Well, the first thing we're going to grab is volatile memory. Not the stuff written to hard drive, but the stuff that's sitting physically on your RAM chip. So we try to collect that because that memory is holding a lot of information. We try to identify processes that are running now that are going to disappear if you pull the plug, as well as network connections, users that are connected locally and remotely, and a lot of miscellaneous file information. The attackers know that you are going to follow a playbook if you go by current law enforcement practices of disconnect the system and pull the plug. Break out of that playbook and grab the information that they're trying to hide and putting into physical memory. And in fact, Stephen, I'll tell you now, the system's memory is the single most important data set we have to collect. And the reason why, and there's more than a couple. First of all, any system that uses whole disk encryption, and there are several products now that are designed to provide additional security by encrypting the entire hard drive, if you pull the plug, when you go to boot the hard drive, that information will return in an encrypted fashion. But if you're dealing with a live system, the physical memory holds a copy of the key that you use to decrypt the system. So if I can go up to a physical system, get a dump of the memory, I can comb through that memory and retrieve the encryption keys so that if I reboot the system to gather any evidence off a hard drive, when prompted for the encryption key, I'll be able to give it what I pulled out of the memory, which is very powerful. In the same way, we can get passwords out of memory. We can identify a lot of processes. And this is one thing. Remember when I told you earlier that there is a problem with signature-based malware products? Well, one of the things the malicious attackers are doing is they're writing malware to work in a system's memory. So what you have to do is grab hold of that memory, because if you pull the plug, then RAM disappears. So if you take a copy of a system memory, you are going to be able to identify hidden processes. In some cases, you can fully extract the malware and rebuild it so that you have a functional copy, and that is everything that was hidden in the memory. Now, to give you an example of this, there are certain pieces of malware, for example, that if you do a search of running processes on your system, you won't see it. If you use a tool, one of the Microsoft PS tools, that malware can remain hidden. And it's not till you dump memory and walk through the individual process blocks that you are able to recreate memory of attacks like Hacker Defender, for example. So this is absolutely incredible, critical to get the processes out of a system memory. Some other things that we're finding in memory are things that are normally not logged, for example, instant messenger chats. So in the case of a missing person, for example, a teenager who's run away, if they've chosen not to log a particular instant message chat, we can still find fragments in the memory, rebuild who they were talking to, what they were talking about, and maybe get enough data out of it that we can find a teenager who's disappeared. And finally, Stephen, one of the things that's really interesting is system memory is not just something we can grab from workstations and servers and laptops, but cell phones and network devices such as VPNs. There are certain VPN vendors that store keys in the system memory. So if you have physical access to that device, you can recover encryption keys. So this is one of the reasons why the physical memory is the important driver, and as well, you've really got to protect physical access to your devices, both from outsiders as well as from potential malicious insiders.
Do you perform this kind of analysis quite often?
And actually, this is one of the interesting things, Stephen, is we are very much leaders in doing this type of forensics, and it used to be done only as a matter of an incident response, or if we were doing forensics on something or assisting in doing forensics trying to locate a missing person, for example. What we have found is we have now incorporated this as an element in regular penetration testing, because we have found that when you're testing a network and you run normal tools, they again are looking for signatures of attacks. And what we are finding is servers that have been up for a long time, it can be up to 30 to 50% of the time they will have malware resident in the memory. And the only way to identify this is to do a memory dump and analysis. So we've taken this forensic tool. It is now part of regular penetration testing. We are doing this on pretty much a daily basis as we go through looking for attacks that may have happened or attacks that are in progress.
Can you explain employee misuse of corporate resources and the role of data forensics?
Employee misuse is probably one of the fastest growing types of incidents that we're dealing with, particularly right now is a period of economic downturn. And this produces a sense of fear, and sometimes this fear is replaced by employees who either stop caring or become actively unhappy with the company they're working for. And frequently this can be as simple as casual vandalism. Employee goes in, they're feeling unhappy with the way the, you know, they're being treated, they feel they've been passed over for promotion, so they will just turn off servers or disconnect cables. And we have seen that, and that is increasing, but that's not a major concern. Normally that can be dealt with in-house. What we're seeing a lot more of is a type of fraud sometimes called conversion fraud. They're spending their corporate time doing stuff that isn't corporate focused. For example, an employee goes in and rather than doing their job, they'll surf the web for 5 or 6 hours. Now normally something like this becomes apparent to the manager, not because the employee is being monitored, but because the employee is just not meeting their requirements. They're not meeting deadlines, for example. But one of the interesting ones we're seeing is employees are running their own business from the cubicle, and they're using corporate resources, envelopes, photocopiers, to facilitate their business. And when it becomes an HR issue like that, we've been called in to see and prove that the employee has violated the company policy, and therefore their employment can be terminated with cause. We had one case a little while ago where a senior system administrator was basically grabbing loose physical items, set up a store on eBay, was selling everything through eBay, and when we did a forensic analysis of their email, we found the setup of the store, we found transfer of funds, we were able to track all the material that had been stolen, and as a result, you know, the person, you know, they were able, from an HR perspective, to justify termination. It is becoming more serious. And I talked earlier about denial of service conditions, damage to corporate data. We have seen several instances, even so far this year, of employees that are stealing data, not just data, but forms, address books, anything electronic that will facilitate them starting their own business and going in and competing against their present employer. So that type of information is leaving, and we're frequently asked in that particular instance, can we prove that this employee copied this data? So the forensics that we're doing is we will find and improper access to data, we will be able to track the data being burned to a CD, and then we'll ask the employee for the CD, and the employee says, well, I know nothing about this. And then when the employee's home computer is finally obtained, we can track the CD being installed and find the stolen data on the home computer. So we can do an end-to-end track of that data. It's just becoming a common practice for us to do so now. The biggest issue that we're starting to see is internal misuse, or the insider threat is no longer just disgruntled employees. Organized crime is now entering into this. And the reason why is quite simple. If I have, for example, a Fortune 500 company that has several different patents, and I want access to those patents, the big company is going to protect them. But if they loan these patents to a smaller company that they've outsourced to, I'm going to attack the smaller company. Less security, less ability to track what I'm doing, and less will to pursue me and bring me to court for what I've done should you ever be able to catch me. So we're seeing that smaller companies, 20 people, up to 200, 2,000, in that range, are a target for organized crime. And for example, one of the things that we've been seeing is that system administrators from organized crime units are getting system admin people placed with various companies. And these system admins will come in, copy all of the relevant data, and then walk out. And because they've had privileged access right from the beginning, it's very hard to track what they've done, and it's very hard to put any controls on what they may have taken. So the economic downturn isn't just disgruntled employees. We have seen a radical shift in the nature and the complexity of insider attacks.
Can you provide your predictions of future IT and business security trends and their implications and opportunities?
Well, I'm going to build on that. First of all, then, we're seeing the nature of the attack has moved away from an amateur or a skilled practitioner up to what we call professionals. In the past 2 years, it is no longer hacking is done for someone that's trying to gain credibility within his hacker community. In 2 years or so, and moving up to now, it is becoming a business. There are significant amounts of money being made, and as a result, the professionalism of the hackers and attackers we're seeing has increased. They have good tools, they're willing to spend their time, and they're targeting their attacks. So one of the things that you can tie to professional attacks is targeted attack. And when someone targets a network, it's like saying that an experienced car thief has targeted your car. You know that you can perform the due diligence of putting in various protective measures, but if a guy wants to steal your car will be gone. In the same way, it is very hard to fully protect a network against someone that targets and wants a specific piece of data from your network. So professionalism, targeted attacks is the implication. The opportunity is, from a security provider point of view, we have to look at making things built in, integral to the network. For example, if you want to have an integrated end-to-end solution such as Forefront sitting across the network, make it completely transparent to the user, and now you've got the ability to focus on looking after a particular attack. Some of the other things that we're starting to see more of, and that's tools are now paying attention to two new trends. The first is what I call, or what is known as, visualization. And it works like this, Stephen. You no longer have 10 servers to monitor. Companies now have their own servers, all their own workstations, connected partners, remote access. How do I sit down and in one location get a view of what is functioning on my network and what is not functioning? So we need a way to bring to the security practitioner a single point view, a snapshot of the network that's easy for them to understand and drill down to what they need to get to know. So that presentation of security information, since last summer, I believe, is when it really started to get recognized and some new tools have come out, is becoming key. Once you have the ability to visualize your network, you then have the ability to apply metrics. And this, I'm talking about meaningful metrics, not, you know, we suffered 8 virus attacks last month and only 3 this month, so we're doing better. No, I'm talking about metrics of this is the amount of viruses that made it into the memory space of these servers. So we've got to extend being able to see our network and being able to measure it. And once we can measure it, we can start fully identifying the stuff that has to be addressed and separated from the background. So those are the big trends that I'm going to go out on a limb and predict. I'm also going to predict as well the final one, and that is as companies are suffering security breaches, more and more you're going to see a requirement for organizations to pay attention to what we call data forensics. It's not just for law enforcement. It's not just to track down one or two particular crimes. It is the way you start in getting a complete picture so that you can close off holes and respond to a greater extent and limit future attacks. So we're seeing data forensics and what, you know, law enforcement used to do is moving closer back into the network. And those are my big predictions.
Robert, you know, you get around quite a bit, and you've been in the industry a long time. You publish, you're widely known, and so on. If you can provide your recommended resources and give a reason why, and it'll save the audience a lot of time.
Probably my number one resource, and I do probably 2.5 hours research online per day, keeping up with emerging attacks as well as how people are responding to them. The number one resource I rely on is, for example, would be Bruce Schneier. Bruce puts out a newsletter called Cryptogram. He has an online blog. And I go there not because Bruce is going to tell me technically how to address an issue, but because he has a way of cutting through, I would say marketing hype, but it's not marketing or media hype, but he cuts through the irrelevant points to focus on what is real about security. Although he comes in and he's a cryptographer by trade, he's coming in and making points that deal with how governments deal with security of nations. Because when you get down to it, security of a network, security of a nation, they share a lot of central tenets. And he is excellent at identifying these and re-exposing them and bringing them back to the acknowledgement of people. So I start off with him in the morning, first thing, to find out what he's read. I also read, there's a blog called Windows Incident Response by Harlan Carvey. If you want to know how to respond to attacks or what people are doing right now to respond to zero days, Harlan Carvey is a technical practitioner. He writes Perl code and releases it out to the community, for example. He writes programs that make things easy to understand, but he also brings together all the zero-day protection you can use when responding to a security incident. So the Windows Incident Response blog is probably the second place that I start every day. There are also several different things, like Microsoft, for example, has, their solution accelerators. They've got various points. So because Microsoft is such a big part of the networks that I'm looking at securing, I will be online to various Microsoft security blogs and security parties to find out what is happening and what is current there. I also go on to other places that look more at sort of where the attackers are coming from, for example, Security Focus. I'm online to see they're a good central point for bringing together information. And then there are, nationally focused for specific things such as laws, and I'll check out various countries' nationally focused blogs and sites. It is a very complex thing to keep up with it all, as I'm sure you understand, because when you're dealing with data attacks, you don't just have to focus on one particular geographical area. Attacks are coming from different places, they're going to different places, and you have to understand what's happening literally across the world, as well as the laws that govern security and privacy. Stephen, probably one of the best resources is to physically go out and network with people that are engaged in the industry itself. And I can speak to a couple different things. There are a lot of security user groups. Most universities now, particularly those that have a security program, have groups that of students, professors, external people who come in that meet and share information, and I think that's a fantastic way of building for the future. There are also lots of groups that exist independent of universities and various focused organizations. For example, the Toronto Area Security Clutch, or TASC, which is probably North America's largest security group. And that brings together experts that not only sit there and share information, but are involved in networking sessions and different types of training that really shares the information. The other way that you can get physically involved with people is to look at some of the different security conferences that occur. For example, I believe everyone should be familiar with Black Hat and DEF CON in Vegas, as well as several other variations of Black Hat. There's the Sector Conference in Toronto. There are conferences that are being held in Europe, particularly some ones that are coming up now. Some of the German, some of the Belgian groups. So globally, there are a lot of places where people can go and share information. We have found through experience that is the number one way of learning what is happening in a real sense, as well as learning some of the tricks that people are using to put security into place and as well as bypass security, the stuff that's going to be happening and the attacks that you're going to be facing in 6 to 8 months. So generally, I urge people to take in at least 2 to 3 conferences per year and select the ones that are going to give them the greatest exposure to this type of knowledge.
So this is the time in my interviews where I kind of turn the table. So if you were doing this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
If I was doing this interview right now, I would be talking very specifically about incident response and how is the environment changing and what should I know to respond to a security incident, not just from a technical perspective, but from a management and an executive perspective. There are some significant changes that are emerging across the world. For example, from an executive perspective, a security incident is stopping from being something that you can control and keep in-house. We are seeing an emergence of laws, and this was driven, I believe it would have been about 4 or 5 years ago in California, when they brought out the first breach reporting law. The majority of U.S. states now require breach reporting. Other countries are starting to follow suit, and it's being driven by consumers that want to know when their personal data has been lost. So no longer do you consider a security breach as something that has happened here. You now have to pay very close attention to the laws that are governing reporting, laws that are governing privacy. We also now have to pay attention to downstream liability. This has been talked about for several years, and downstream liability is the acknowledgement that if you fail to keep your network secure and an attacker uses it to attack someone else, you are culpable in that attack. Last year was the first example of downstream liability being enacted. A particular company that was compromised had to make restitution to banks to cover the cost of reissuing credit cards that had been revealed during the security breach. So you're starting to see more and more people want to hold someone responsible for the cost behind a security breach, and they can be quite significant. And these are new executive concerns. From the management level, we're putting upon people a brand new challenge, and that's this. How do you secure a network as cost-effectively as possible and maintain a high degree of security? And it's a significant challenge now because a lot of people don't like paying for security. Until you've suffered a security breach, it's like buying a first aid kit that sits in the back of the car. Okay, yeah, I've got the first aid kit. If I ever cut myself, I'm okay, but I'm not going to keep spending money on it. It's there in the back of the car. In the same sense, managers will pay for IT people to be trained in incident response and then assume the training that they received 3 years ago will suffice when they get hacked tomorrow. And that training won't even teach them how to recognize an incoming attack, let alone how to deal with it. So cost-effective response is probably the greatest management challenge right now that is being faced. And then there is a significant amount of what we call technical focus. And that is incident response now requires you to have an understanding not just of your network and how it's configured, but you've got to understand how malware works, how attacks are working. You've got to understand forensics because you could be collecting data and you have to treat that data like it's going to court because it's possible that you may be able to identify the attacker and hold them responsible. And the trick is are your IT people prepared to maintain the chain of evidence such that it would stand in court. So there are enormous challenges at all levels in responding to incidents.
In all of your travels, do you have any stories that you can tell? Again, not naming any specific companies or groups, but from an anecdotal standpoint.
Well, there's a significant amount of stories, and one of my favorites brings up to the forefront a challenge that a lot of organizations fail to acknowledge, and that's this. When you are doing data security, there are automatic blinders that are put on saying, well, that must be computers, that must be hard drives and disks, we'll keep them secure. I have actually been to an emergency response center, a backup site, and we were doing the security test of the whole area and went outside, and there was a ladder leaned up against the roof. So I climbed up on the roof of the building, and the roof hatch was open, and it was quite a large hatch because it had been cut in the roof to allow the power supply, a monster industrial UPS, to be lowered into this building. And it was open. And although they didn't know why the ladder was there, they could tell me that the roof hatch was unlocked because locks did not come out of the budget for data security. They came out of the budget for facilities. And the facilities department had not allocated money for that particular single lock to lock up this entry point into their data center. So for want of a $6 lock, anyone could have climbed up a ladder, gone through this roof hatch, and into a recovery data center that was unmanned 24/7. Nothing but very expensive machines sitting there. So I thought this was pretty funny that you would have this loss of security because there was a schism between facility and data security. When 2 weeks ago, Lawrence Livermore Labs announced that they had lost 67 computers in the past year. And now this is a company that handles, or an organization that handles, nuclear secrets. And it had not been brought to the attention of the IT people because lost laptops are a facilities issue. So one of the most common themes that I see when I'm on the ground talking to people is this schism between what constitutes physical security and what constitutes data security.
Well, that was a really fascinating story, and I can see sort of the communications that are necessary and people sort of working together as well when you're any kind of environment. And if you don't get that sort of collaboration occurring, you can get these holes appearing.
Yeah, and in fact, sometimes it's even simpler than that. I was actually at a computer security research lab, and when we walked out of the lab and let the door close, and keep in mind, to get in, you had to go through biometric scanners. You had to use special keys. You went into a double door system. When we left and shut the door didn't shut. And I looked down, and the strike plate, which is right on the edge of that door, it's held on with a couple screws. One of the screws had come out, and as a result, the strike plate was wobbling, and it would swing out about a quarter of an inch, so that if you walked out and just shut the door, the strike plate kept that door from closing. So if you walk down the hall, you could bypass all their biometric scanners and everything, just pull the door open. It was a 5-cent screw that was the source of the issue. But again, it becomes a matter of people aren't paying attention to what the purpose is, and that is to secure the data. They seem to think that, oh, well, it's all logical security, and they're failing to take into account, you know, the physical and the facilities and everything else. So it's very common to see something like this, Steve.
So do you have any other closing comments or stories before we close off the interview?
Well, there's nothing specific because every time you go out, there's always a particular story. My favorite one, actually, see, part of the problem is the stories for me that I find funny are revealing very major security holes for different organizations. But I was at a particular site on the day of 9/11. And because of what was happening that day, we canceled all our meetings. But one of my things that I had been down there to do was to do a physical security walkthrough. And during the walkthrough that afternoon, I asked the person leading me around if they've ever done a fire drill. And the response was no, but after today, they were going to put a process in place to have one, and they anticipated having one sometime in the fall, later in the fall. And it just brought to my mind that a lot of things that are relatively simple tend to get overlooked. And the trick in security, and as in all things, is to know what to overlook and not to overlook. And things like, you know, keeping people safe, it's something that should be, you know, attention should always be paid sooner rather than later.
Well, Robert, you know, you have this amazing background, and you've been involved in so many cases around the world providing your expertise. So we really appreciate you coming in to do the interview, and we will continue to follow your significant contributions. And we thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and accumulated deep insights with our audience.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Stephen. It's been great. I really enjoyed the opportunity.
This concludes our exclusive interview with Robert Biggs, International Security Authority, Board Member, Sector Advisory Council, President, Digital Defense.